You've landed inside Launch Street, the Business Innovation Podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate, differentiate, and get further faster. Since you're here, we know you're the type of person that recognizes the importance of unlocking your innovation advantage so you can compete and win. And now, your host, the person that has worked with leading companies like Disney, Procter & Gamble, Arrow Electronics, the U.S. Army Research Labs, and Red Robin on upping their innovation advantage, Tamara Gontor.
What's up, innovators? Tamara here, your innovation enabler, and if it were up to me, the person who would spend hours perusing the shelves of the grocery store, exploring all the new products. I love it so much. But who has the time? Oh, I wish I did. I get all my groceries delivered. All right, I have a question for you. Have you gone onto our website and taken our free innovation assessment? It will help you discover how you innovate best so that you can perform at your peak and bring those game-changing innovative solutions to your biggest challenges. So we built this tool to be able to empower you to unlock your greatest competitive advantage. Your innovative mind, as you can tell by the energy in my voice, I'm pretty excited about it and I'm excited to offer it to the world. So when you are done listening, go to our website and invest 7 minutes, that's all it takes, in yourself. It's going to help you be that rock star innovator on your team and in life. By the way, what you'll discover is that everyone innovates, even you. But how we all innovate is unique to each of us. So go find out how you innovate. Unlock that superpower inside of you. Okay, to our interview. Doesn't it feel like change is the word of the year? If you could see me, I'm doing air quotes around the word change right now. I think it has so many different meanings to so many people too. But we talk so much about the accelerated rate of change, the pace of it. And it's absolutely true. I mean, we talk about how technology, the competition, kind of the speed to market, how that's all constantly in a state of flux. But what we don't talk about is the customer and their expected rate of change. Where do they fit in? This is why I had on Braden Kelly on Inside Launch Street. He's an innovation thought leader, the genius behind Innovation Excellence, which I don't know if you've been there yet, highly recommend it. It's a website, it's kind of a hub for innovation thought leadership. I actually post articles on there as well. So he's all about innovation and he's built a bunch of innovation tools as well that large companies use to help drive innovation. He talked to me about how the biggest challenge we face isn't just technology, it's the customer's increased expectations around rate of change, how the fast flow of information is causing this. And more importantly, I think for all of us, he kind of gave us the secret sauce for how to combat it. It's called trust. He talks a little bit more about what that means, but trust is how you battle all this crazy change. We also dig into how being agile actually include some level of fixedness. I know we don't think of them as going together, but they do. So let's get to this. Well, hello, Braden. It's so good to finally have you on the show and actually connect with you kind of live, I guess.
Well, I'm super excited to be speaking with you today, tomorrow, that's for sure.
So what's the one thing people would be surprised to learn about you?
I think people would be super surprised if they looked at my height or my stature that I'm really into playing basketball. I mean, I'm not short, you know, I'm 5'8", which used to be the average, but
not for basketball players.
But not for basketball players. And so people would be surprised that I'm an avid basketball player and actually pretty good at.
Okay, so here's my question then. Do you have a strength or a skill that the tall guys don't have that you can leverage? And I'm kind of asking because back in the day, I used to box. And when I did it, because I'm old, there were no women's leagues. So I boxed guys, which sounds horrible, but I was always faster and could get up close sooner and get out of the way. So I had to leverage that. So do you have, as a not 6'5" person, can you leverage that?
Yes. So the way that I leverage my height is to be able to change direction more quickly. And then my superpower is the ability to see what's going to happen and to put the ball where it needs to be to get other people open. So I'm really good at getting other people open. And then if people leave me open, I have a good mid-range shot to you know, make people pay for leaving me open.
Well, there you go. Well, nice. Well done. Well, I feel like your comment around, you know, seeing what's going to happen is a great segue into our conversation about innovation and change. I just want to open it up kind of macro level first. How do you think the quote unquote rate of change that we're experiencing is impacting businesses and their need to innovate today versus, you know, even 5 or 10 years ago?
Sure. So I definitely think that the rate of change is accelerating, and there's a number of different reasons why this is occurring. And actually, Innosight did a piece of research that I reference quite frequently about the average age of companies in the S&P 500 and how that's declined over the last, you know, 50, 60 years. And it's gone from an average of like, you know, 50 to 60 years down to 20.
Wow.
So that's a huge change. And the reason is that it's, you know, much easier with all the technology that we have available to start a company, to scale a company. And also, you know, another reason that the rate of change is accelerating is the rate of customer expectations and their change is accelerating. And so companies have to cope with the fact that, you know, if you or I have a great experience at one company, then we expect every other company to deliver that same experience.
I was talking with a group of customer service individuals, and we were having that conversation that it doesn't matter what business you're in, you're as good as your customer's last experience with somebody else. So you need to compare to that. I want to dig a little bit, though, into this customer expectations rate of change, because I think we talk a lot about technology and, you know, AI and kind of all of that changing really quickly and being faster than it used to. But will you talk a little bit about what you mean by customer expectations and their rate of change being faster, too? Because I think that's the part we fail to talk about.
Well, I think part of it is what you mentioned, that your experience must be as good as the customer's last experience. So there's that angle to it. But then also information flows faster than ever before. So it used to be that you just had to worry about having a good name or a bad name in your local community. And now, you know, things have gone global. And now people can post information and reach thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of people very quickly. And information disseminates quickly. And people can also, you know, learn a lot faster than they can. I mean, there's a lot of great examples of people like communities like surfers becoming really, really good at surfing really, really fast because now they have YouTube videos to access and they can watch, you know, different techniques that people are using and then they can practice those and learn those and pick those up. So the rate of information flow is another key component to why change has accelerated.
That's a great point. And it seems to me to, from the customer perspective, that we customers are now ready for disruption. So it used to be, right, that, you know, you had your big players in whatever industry and then someone would come in and disrupt and then they'd become the big player and we'd all kind of, you know, follow along. Now it seems like we're so used to think people and industries and brands and products being disrupted that we're almost like, oh, okay, so whatever this is I'm doing now, I probably won't be doing in a year. I'll just wait for the next thing anyway. So it's like we're waiting for the disruption to happen too because it's so accepted now. Does that make sense? I'm kind of talking in circles, so hopefully that makes sense.
I understand what you're saying, but I think the one thing that sort of stands in the way of that is where customers have developed a level of trust with a particular organization. And so they give that organization more time to adapt than they would, you know, an organization that they didn't trust. So if you have a really good relationship with XYZ company and they've always followed through and they've always taken care of you and they deliver a good experience and they have good service and their products work well, quality's good. You know, if you've got all these things that make you, you know, feel really good about the company that you're working with, you know, if some new company comes along with something that looks a little bit better, you're more likely to talk to your existing company that you're working with and try to have them create something very similar that solves the problem in the same basic way rather than jump to another company because you might lose all these good things that the company is giving you now.
It's basically like a relationship. You'll stick with it in the hard times and give them a chance to fix it.
Exactly.
How, you know, I think we talk a lot about innovations need to innovate. How, and actually I should say with that, people on their teams being innovative to make that happen. How do you make, as you talk about innovation, accessible to everyone on your team, even in a large organization?
Sure. So there's a lot of different things that come together to make that possible and make that, you know, a successful effort on your behalf. And one of the things that I obviously talk about is something that I've created over the years, which is the 9 innovation roles, which was designed to help people switch from this idea that I really hate that some people are promoting out there, that you're either innovative or you're not. Because, you know, my view is that everybody has a role to play in innovation, and the 9 innovation roles capture the different ways that people might participate in innovation, or the types of things that they gravitate towards in making a contribution to innovation. And so, you know, if people go to 9roles.com, they can see what those are, and they can even download the card design that I created with a great developer and on a crowdsourcing platform, and, you know, just print them out themselves. But it's all centered around the idea that you have people that, you know, are the revolutionaries, the noisy ideas people, and the connectors, the people that know where the resources live in the organization and who knows what and who has what. And then there's 7 other roles that all come together to make innovation happen. And it's not necessarily that you need all the roles represented at all times, but you're going to need them at different points in time. And some roles are more important at different points in time of the innovation process. And it can be really powerful for people to understand the roles that they gravitate towards and the roles that people have on their team and which roles are missing on the team and within the organization even, or where they're scarce. So it's a powerful tool for changing the mindset away from that innovative or not. But then also other ways that you can help everybody be innovative is just by, you know, setting the guardrails for people and painting a good picture for how you're going to innovate and how people can participate and making sure that the resources are in place to support it. So there's a whole innovation infrastructure that I put together and visualized that helps people, you know, sort of consciously think through all the things that go into that.
You know, I've seen the 9 roles, and they're I think interesting and more importantly valuable to understand. And your comments about kind of how everybody participates and everybody has a role, I think couldn't be more true. I you know, it's why we created our innovation assessment that tells you how you innovate, different people and the different styles of innovation. Because mm-hmm. I was so tired of people saying to me, well, I'm not innovative, but Braden, he's the guy, right? Like, you want to talk to him down the hall, like, he's the one with the blue streak in his hair and, you know, says all the crazy things. It's always that person. And it's so, I think for companies, it's so important that that they recognize and empower people to understand how they innovate so they can be a part of the process. Because I think over time, we're actually talked out of thinking we know how to innovate, or what, to your point, what our role is in innovation. And I was having a conversation in Indianapolis with someone from one of the big auto companies. And they said, you know, the company just set up a team to innovate, and the rest of us, we're supposed to be staying in our lanes. And I was like, huh. Yep. Like, so let me understand this. There's 10 people with cool shirts. They get to be disruptive and they get to be crazy, and you don't get to innovate. Like, how does that work? And to me, that really hinders innovation all the way around. And not saying everybody has to be wildly disruptive, but there's opportunities to innovate every single day. So from your perspective, what do structures like that do to the actual operationalizing of innovation?
Well, what I've found is that often they put the focus on launching things and away from actually creating innovation. So I won't name the company, but a company that I worked with in the past, an insurance company, had one of those teams where it was their job to do things, and they were launching things that already existed in the marketplace.
Well, that's helpful.
So I'm not sure exactly what innovation was going on there, but but you know, when you get what you reward, right? So if you build an innovation team, then and it's their job to innovate rather than facilitating and empowering others to innovate, then what you get is they feel like they have to launch things, and in order to do that, then you start taking a shorter time horizon and you start creating things that either already exist or that are slight tweaks on something that already exists, so that you can get something out in the marketplace and say that you've done something. You get line extensions and you get brand extensions and different things like that, rather than true innovation.
You know, I think too that what I've seen, to just to build on to that, is if that team does create something innovative that, you know, fits with the company, is it then becomes this one-way tennis match, because when the brand managers or business managers have to take it on, they weren't a part of it because it was behind the black curtain. So they don't want it. It's more work. So, you know, it becomes this, like, these ideas get lobbed over the fence and nobody's on, not only they're not catching it, they're ducking and weaving, hoping not to catch it. One of the things that you talk about is helping organizations, and hopefully I got this quote right, increase their organizational agility and accelerate their speed of innovation. How do you do that? Because I think those two words are really key when you think about how a company innovates.
Sure. So I think that one place that you start is understanding, you know, where agility comes from and the difference between agility and flexibility. And flexibility is one component to agility. And on the other side, you have fixedness. So in order to be agile, you have to have certain things that don't change. Because if you try to change everything all the time and, you know, resources are perfectly flexible, then they're not very good at any one thing. But if you're too fixed on where you invest effort in terms of any kind of resource, whether it's a human resource or a physical resource, and they become really, really specialized at doing that thing that they're doing really, really, really well, but then they can't do anything else worth a darn. So if you want to be agile, you have to strike that balance between flexibility and fixedness so that you can move resources from one doing one thing to another as needed, but without changing everything.
So we talked a little bit about how to do that, because I in theory, like, I agree, right? So you can't have everything in limbo, because then nothing really moves forward. You're just always changing. But how do you, can you give me an example, actually, maybe a story of a client that you've helped balance those two things? Because I know there are some launch readers out there listening going, that's great, but how do I know where there's room and where I shouldn't change?
So I think that it is a very challenging thing, and it's different for every organization. Every organization has to kind of think through, you know, what are those things that, you know, it doesn't make sense to be changing. Where do we get our greatest efficiencies from? And there are certain things that we may not want to change. And so it's, you know, as any organization tries to think through this challenge, oftentimes, it's one of the first things they run into is, you know, how do we innovate? And, you know, a lot of times people have a struggle finding time to innovate. And so that's one of the first areas that companies have to explore this balance between flexibility and fixedness. And one interesting solution that I've seen out there that a company is doing is that Cisco has this idea of internal internships. And so the idea there is that, it's a good way for people to, you know, get exposure to different parts of the organization while they're still doing their day job. So then that means that HR has to build in some level of flexibility into how you staff for things and such, right? So you've got that idea. And so part of the benefit comes to the employee and they become a more flexible resource to the organization. But at the same time, you're still leveraging the fixedness and their expertise and their day job. And then the other benefit the organization gets is whichever team is hiring the intern from inside the organization to work part-time on a project, is they're getting external perspectives from outside their group, and they're getting exposed to different ways of thinking and different ways of doing things that other parts of the organization might be engaging in. And so they, you know, from that experience, you know, potentially become more innovative because they have more diverse ways of thinking about things.
That's really cool. And I would have to imagine too, right, that if you're the one doing the internship, when you go back to your job, you probably have a much better understanding of how all the pieces fit together, not just your job, but what happens kind of up and downstream from you.
Yes. And you may have experienced or seen things that are different from the way that you do them in your home group and may have learned things from that.
Yeah, that's very cool. One of the things I wanted to make sure to ask you about was how a long adoption curve can kill innovation. So, you know, oftentimes I find that teams will come up with these, you know, incredible innovative ideas, and then it takes a really long time for whether it's internal buy-in stakeholders or actually the marketplace, the customer, to to get it, right? To kind of catch up to the idea in a lot of ways, and it kills mm-hmm. it, which you talk a lot about. So will you talk a little bit about that, kind of how it does that, and then how do you accelerate the adoption curve so that you don't hit that cliff? Because it really is such a big problem, especially for those, I'd say, more disruptive ideas.
Sure. So there's several things that operate together to make that the case. And the first is people confuse invention with innovation, mm-hmm. and they're not the same things. So, you know, to make that jump, to cross the chasm in Geoffrey Moore's terms from invention to innovation, you have to make it widely adopted. It has to usually replace something that already exists, and that may be the do-nothing solution. And so there's a lot of things that have to occur for an invention to become an innovation. And so that's number one. The second thing that's very correlated to that is that people think that innovation just comes from value creation, and that's right. just one component, and that's the invention component. But people also have to understand the value translation component, which is helping people understand how this new thing is going to fit into their lives. And that may run the span from explanation on the incremental side to education on the disruptive side. And that can take a while to help people understand this new thing. And we're kind of going through that with autonomous driving right now. And some people are doing it better than others.
Give me an example for the autonomous driving.
So as we think about the value translation component, we understand that computers are advancing quickly and that they might be able to drive the car. And we understand that most humans are bad drivers.
What?
That's just, especially the other ones, right?
Yeah.
Not me.
No, it's everybody on the road but me.
So we understand that, but you know, there's a lot of things that have to happen, and people need to perfect their value translation around autonomous driving before people will give up the wheel. And you know, even if the technology is ready, you have to get it to the point where, you know, people are willing to give up the wheel. And we kind of saw that with the Segway. The Segway hasn't achieved the wide adoption that they were initially anticipating because they did a bad job with value translation and understanding the barriers that they're going to face with local governments, because their intention was that this Segway device would be just people ride around the sidewalks.
Right.
What's the problem?
Right.
And they didn't realize that the magnitude of the problem that they were addressing and trying to make that possible in every municipality in the U.S., let alone the world. And so the value translation piece is the most neglected of the three components of innovation. And it's the thing that you need to make the best plan for if you want to make that transition from invention to innovation. And then the final one is value access. And that's about, you know, how do you help people access the value that you've created? And so if you look at something like the iPod, it was something that people had never seen before, didn't really understand. And so, you know, Apple created things like the Apple stores and the Genius bars because they knew that the big box stores weren't going to be able to do that value translation component well enough to make people adopt the device.
Is there a piece of it for, maybe it's in the value translation that's about giving people an anchor to understand what it is? Like, I'll just use your iPod example for a second. It was totally revolutionary on one hand. On the other hand, I totally understood music being portable, right? I had my yellow Sportsman Walkman before I had my MP3 player, right? Before I had the iPod. So by the time it came out, I was like, oh, okay, music in my pocket. I get it. Totally revolutionary way of doing it. Uber, kind of the same thing. Like, okay, now I'm hiring people, like just random people, but okay, I get it. I tell somebody I need to go somewhere and they pick me up. One of my favorite examples is flax milk. So, you know, it's called milk so that people understand how and when to use it. If you said flax juice, nobody would know what to do with it. I'm curious from your perspective, if there's a piece of it that's, you know, a handle that people can say, oh, okay, totally new, but here's where it's familiar to me.
I'm gonna steal that milk example.
Yeah.
That's a great one.
Yeah.
because it's not milk. I mean,
no, it's flax juice, really.
it's ground up
what
nuts,
would you
water,
do with that?
and tree gum.
Right. So it's funny how that's not appealing. Interesting.
It's actually pretty nasty when you think about
right.
it. But, So yes. So what I like to talk about in reference to what you're asking is that, you know, on that explanation side, when something's more incremental, it's easier to make that direct connection to something they're already familiar with. It's when something is more disruptive, there's more steps in between, or there's more links in the chain that you have to build in order to connect the two things. So the more that's why I talk about explanation, because you're anchoring it to things that people already understand versus education. And so education is a process. So it's building that chain.
Yeah, I love your Apple example too, because I never really thought about their Apple stores and their, you know, the Genius Bar. I always thought of it as that's a place to hawk product, but really there was an adoption curve they needed to get over and people needed to come in and ask questions.
And they needed to be able to demonstrate the device and what it did. I mean, if you go into a big box store, you know, at least at that time, maybe it's better now. The device was there on the shelf and
not better.
And that's it.
Not
so
better.
how are you going to be able to see that you can easily navigate your entire CD collection in a single device, navigate 1,000 songs without clicking, you know, one forward and back button like
right.
Previous MP3 players.
Right, right. You know, my son and I went to the Apple store the other day. We had a Genius appointment and like an hour to wait. So we put our selfies on every phone in that store. The guy said to me, he goes, "You're not the first one, honey. We deleted every night." And I was like, damn. I thought I was so good.
That's funny.
So one of the reasons we know each other is because you run a website, Innovation Excellence, which is really a lack of a better way to say it, a knowledge hub where innovation thought leaders post articles, which I have the honor of contributing to. So you've seen a lot of ideas and perspective and thoughts come across that website, which will, for launch readers, we'll put a link in the show notes for you because it is a great resource for innovation of all kinds, brave stuff along with others as well. I'm curious, any, you know, as you kind of think through some of the things you've seen on there, anything that stood out to you and why, whether that's, you know, lessons learned or kind of a surprising take on things?
Sure. So first, thanks for contributing. It's great to have you on the site.
Love it. Thank you.
Great to have as many great perspectives as possible to have that diversity of thought. And in relation to that question, you know, kind of thought about it here for a second. And the one that jumps out is probably our first article, which was Rowan Gibson, one of the co-founders, a fellow author and speaker. He wrote an innovation manifesto that we launched the site with. And he came out of the advertising industry, so he's a great writer, and especially in that motivational style. And so that's the one that stood out for me, because I think as you look at innovation, people often need permission to innovate. And so having a vision, strategy, goals, you know, a lot of these infrastructure components and, you know, inspiring people and helping them be curious are very key to innovation success in organizations. And so I like the manifesto and kind of setting that direction for what you're trying to do and helping people see what you're trying to do.
Yeah, I really like it. I went and found it when I was first kind of looking around the site, and I really liked it. I want to take a little bit of a tangent because of something you just said about people need to feel like they have permission, and then you've got all these processes and whatnot. I often find when companies bring me in that they talk about having a culture of permission to innovate, but that's not actually how people feel. They don't feel it. No matter how much it's said, it kind of becomes lip service, I think, to them. And that's probably for a combination of reasons. What do you think it really takes to get people to feel like they have true permission to innovate in kind of their, not if they're the innovation team, but as we were talking about, really in their day-to-day jobs? How do you do that? I mean, it's a big question, right? Like, we could be here for 2 hours, probably.
Well, I think use a baseball analogy. You don't throw a ball at someone without giving them a mitt. So, and what most organizations do is throw lots of baseballs at their employees without giving them a mitt to know how to catch them.
That is a great analogy.
And so companies too often fail to invest or think through or put in place that back end of innovation to process the contributions that employees might make. And so people feel like, well, even if I contributed something, it's not going to go anywhere. And so unless you start out very consciously making sure that you have a very crisp and crisp process in place for how you're going to process ideas and make that very clear to people how that's going to work. And people feel like they can be part of that process, whether they want to, you know, or whether it makes sense for them to be involved all the way through the process or just hand off the idea and have a team of people pick it up and run with it. If you don't, you know, put those things in place from the very beginning, then you're just wasting your time.
Yeah, I love the baseball. I don't even follow baseball, but I get the analogy because it hurts too, right? When you kept getting hit in the face with baseballs, if you have no mitt, which is how I think sometimes innovation in the workplace feels. Like, it's painful because it's just this like vicious cycle. And it seems like companies or leaders oftentimes, and I've been guilty of this too, we tell people, okay, go innovate, but we don't actually give them the tools to do it. We just expect them to know how. Mm-hmm. And that mitt, as you talked about, is such an important part of getting people to actually do it.
Yes, yes. And the tools are important too. And that's part of the reason that, you know, I wrote a book the first time around and then didn't think I was going to write another book. And so, but then, you know, faced a lot of pain in some of the things that I was doing and recognized that when it comes to organizational change and really when it comes to innovation, that there's a lot of tools out there that are just missing or very bad. Yeah. And so I didn't write a book the second time around. I created a toolkit. And then after I created the change planning toolkit with more than 50 tools to help people plan and execute organizational change, because innovation is all about change, then it made sense to write a book to help explain the toolkit. And because innovation and change both require collaboration, then I also brought in some very interesting and powerful voices from outside myself to contribute to the book and add some interesting case studies and next practices around organizational change. So you know, you don't want to build a house with your hands. You want to build it with tools. And it's a lot more comfortable and a lot faster.
I love these analogies. It's so good. I'm like, hey, you're right. Good point. I might not do that.
I think that there's a lot of, so you want to give people tools to help them innovate. That's key. And you want to help people have that freedom and that reinforcement that it's important to be curious. You want to inspire them. And, you know, I like to talk about innovation always starts with inspiration.
I want to ask about the toolkit. So I know a lot of leaders and teams have used it. I'm just curious from the feedback, what can you share kind of one or two of the tools that are in there that have really resonated with clients or readers?
So the one thing that resonates the most with people is the change planning canvas. And that was that by intent, because that's designed to be the central asset. It's kind of where you capture the most important things all in one place and helps you literally get everybody all on the same page for change. And so you imagine big poster sized piece of paper with a bunch of sticky notes on it. That's how it's designed to be used. And so that one's gotten a lot of feedback. And then as I was, you know, doing work with people, one of the things that emerged based on things that people were talking about with, you know, the big buzz around design thinking and prototyping and all these things was that there wasn't something to help guide experiments. So I also created an experiment canvas, and I've made that available for free on the website for download.
Oh, great.
And so it's a way of helping to structure the way that people think through the crafting of an experiment, especially what you're hoping to learn.
Right.
Because it's not about failing fast, it's about learning fast. And so I created the experiment canvas to try to help people learn fast.
So I want to flip over to your book. You kind of briefly mentioned a book, Stoking Your Innovation Bonfire. One of the things that I really liked that you wrote about in there is helping leaders remove the obstacles that cripple innovation, superpowers, I think is how you call it. what are some of those obstacles and how do you overcome them? If you thought about the kind of one or two big ones.
Sure. So, you know, risk management does not come without a cost. And as organizations start trying to manage risk more and more, that's where innovation oftentimes becomes harder and harder, because we put more barriers in place for how things get done and how quickly things can get done. That's one thing, or kind of information and structural barriers. But organizational psychology is probably the biggest barrier to innovation. And that's where people feel like they can't fail, or they can't take risks, or, you know, they just don't feel like it's their job, or, you know, a lot of different reasons. But then there's, you know, other key obstacles, like not having a vision, strategy, and goals, not building your innovation off of customer insight, you know, just thinking you know, rather than going and finding out. So there's there's a whole host of them. The book's built around looking at what the obstacles are, the barriers to innovation, and how to overcome them. So that's kind of where the genesis came, as nobody was taking that approach.
Do you think with the kind of people don't feel like they can innovate, that that's just a like unfortunate cultural side effect that you know, happens over time? Is that the people you hire, a combination of all of the above? I'm always curious, like how do we get to that place where a team, a company, you know, the people inside of it, as much as we all say we want innovation, feel like it's not really a part of it?
Well, I think it's when the organization reaches a certain size and everything starts to change to try to make it, you know, more operationally efficient. So another guy I know, Les McCown, he writes a lot about things in this area, about the different stages that organizations go through and the changes that they need to make as they go through different sizes. And so I think we just, in order to make things efficient, we start to give up certain things and we start to move more on that range between exploration to exploitation. We shift all the way to exploitation, trying to be efficient and effective as possible. And it's, you have to strike that balance. You have to have that 80-20 where 80% of your efforts are focused on doing everything as efficiently and effectively as possible. And 20% is inefficient and ineffective as you're looking for the things that are going to replace your machine.
It's interesting that you say that, because there's two companies in Colorado in particular that I think went through that life cycle, Otterbox and WhiteWave Foods. Both started out very innovative, very entrepreneurial, and then grew and grew and grew. And they hit a tipping point where it felt like they went, and they will tell you this, this is not, you know, kind of just my insight, this is their leadership and their companies have told me, they hit a tipping point where they started hiring people from, you know, the big consumer packaged goods companies in an effort to bring in processes and structure. But in an effort to do that, they lost the innovative spirit that got them there in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it was interesting. But now they're trying really hard to get it back, which I would imagine is hard to do.
It's definitely hard, and so it's a constant tug of war between, you know, that operational excellence and innovation excellence, and you have to pursue both at the same time if you want to remain relevant for the long haul.
What do you think is one of the biggest myths about innovation out there that is actually hindering our efforts? You had mentioned earlier the whole, like, it's, you know, for somebody else, not for me, that conversation, but is there anything else of those big myths that we're buying into that we really shouldn't?
Well, I think that the biggest myth out there is that it's all about new product development.
Yeah.
I think that reinforces a project-centric approach to innovation. And, you know, anytime you take a project-centric approach to innovation rather than building the infrastructure and the culture, then you might get one really good success, but then have a hard time repeating it because you're not sure what created it in the first place.
That's a great point. And I think sometimes in thinking that it's the new product, the new technology, whatever, we lose opportunities to innovate on processes, structure, other ways where it could actually make a big impact, but we don't think of it that way.
Mm-hmm.
So before I ask you the last question, where can people go to learn and connect with you?
So they can go to bradenkelly.com, bradenkelly.com, or they can also check out innovationexcellence.com as well. You know, everything about the tools and the toolkit, and there's a bunch of free downloads and links to my books and everything is all on bradenkelly.com.
And launch readers out there listening, I cannot encourage you enough to go to Innovation Excellence and Braden's personal site, but really there are so many resources on Innovation Excellence. I mean, I, as an innovation expert and contributor, go there to learn about other things about innovation as well. So I contribute to it, but I'm also a big learner from it as well. So I couldn't encourage it more. All right. So the last question for you, since we're bumping up on time, is what's one piece of advice you have for launch readers out there that are looking to really drive that innovation and change and thrive in this rate of constant change and disruption that we've been talking about?
Don't stand still. So one of my favorite sayings is that, you know, if you stand still, you're going to get run over from behind. So don't be afraid to try things. Don't be afraid to experiment. Don't be afraid to pick up some tools even and try those out and see how they help you or not in your innovation efforts. Because, you know, the one thing, given the rate of change, for that's for sure, is that if you stand in one place as a company or as an individual, somebody else is going to take your spot.
That is so true. And do you think that standing in place is that the, just to contextualize it for people, is that the kind of like, I was successful yesterday, so I'm going to do that today. This is the way I've always done it. Like, how does that manifest itself in what you're doing? I want launch shooters out there to really understand it so they can change it.
Sure. So it's important to both focus on improvement and on innovation. They're not mutually exclusive, but if too often what happens is we're successful at something, and so we try to increment on that and improve whatever that is without looking at other ways that we can create value or deliver value for customers. And we, it's not just about asking customers what they want, but understanding customer movement, because customers move over time and what they expect, what they're looking for, what kinds of solutions they want. The world's moving all around us, so everything's moving. And so the biggest thing is to understand how things are moving so you can continue to deliver solutions that are relevant and understand what you're trusted to do. How can you extend your brands or your offerings and still have success with customers based on, you know, what they're actually trusting you for?
I've got one more question for you. I hope that's okay. As you were talking, sure. Got me thinking of something else. How from your perspective do you distinguish between what is real innovation and to your the thing that you said that got me thinking about this was, you know, what you're trusted to do and where you can play versus just leaping on the latest trend, you know, that may or may not come and go. A woman on LinkedIn, I was just scrolling before I got on this interview with you, and she had put up a QR code to some page, I don't even know what. And I just thought, wow, that was something that came and went. Like everybody jumped on and then walked away from, you know? Not everybody, but most. It just wasn't what everyone thought it was going to be. So I'm curious from your perspective, how do you distinguish between those two so that you're really, so that the decisions that you make and the innovation that you try to drive isn't just about, oh my God, now it's Snapchat. Oh my God, now customers are doing this, but really the right path for you.
Well, I think that one way of thinking about it is, are we looking at a problem in search of a solution or a solution in search of a problem? That's one way of looking at it. But, you know, my definition for innovation, I think, encompasses a lot of the things that people should consider. And that's that innovation transforms the useful seeds of invention into widely adopted solutions valued above every existing alternative. And so a true innovation is going to, number one, deliver greater value than any other way of solving the problem. And it's going to do it in a way that people are going to want to abandon their existing way of solving that problem.
Okay, I'm going to ask you one last question because you've said it a few times about the importance of it being widely adopted. Mm-hmm. I just want for launch readers out there for you to give us some context as to why that matters. I don't want to be assumptive that everybody out there listening understands kind of where that fits in. So if you could just talk for a second about why that matters so much.
It matters because if you look at something like the mousetrap, so everybody says, if you build a better mousetrap, people beat a path to your door. That's the quote, right?
Yeah.
Well, it's something like 400 people every year get new patents for mousetraps.
Really?
So you would have to assume that these hundreds of people every year that have built better mousetraps, people should be beating
rich.
A path to their door, right?
So rich.
But most of us still use these old wooden ones that, you know, costs 30 cents or whatever. Yep. So that's what I have to say about that.
Right. So people need to actually want it and use it, basically. Otherwise, what's the point? All right. I swear I'm done with questions. Braden, thank you so much for joining us on Launch Street. That was a wealth of information. And for Launch Streeters, I will be sure to put links in the show notes so that you can access all this great stuff.
Great. Thanks, Tamara.
And that's a wrap, innovators. Agility, innovation roles, customer trust. So much goodness. I want you to think about what you can do to build trust with your customers, the people that you serve. How do you combat this massively fast rate of change that we're dealing with? And hey, please, please, please don't forget to go take the assessment and discover how you bring innovation into the world. I want you to unlock your superpowers. So go. Don't wait. Go. Bye-bye. Go. Okay. Tamara out.
Thanks for hanging with us on Inside Launch Street. If you know someone that is truly ready to unlock their innovation advantage, have them join you on Launch Street. Discover your innovation advantage. Build a team of high-performing innovators and ignite ideas and solutions that create massive impact. GOTO, LaunchStreet.com. Remember, innovators, if you don't take the leap, somebody else will.